Ulrich swung around with his big hands tied into fists.
So what's going to happen, huh?
Wolf sat on a stool with his belly on his thighs and hands on his knees. He'd visibly aged as the thrill of the high adventure ebbed. Perhaps the exploit he'd hoped to cap his double life with was going to sour on his tongue.
What do you mean, Ulrich? The lawyer asked wearily.
Ulrich turned him a look of outrage.
Well, I mean it is our deadline. It's 10 o'clock. You heard the radio. They still haven't met our demands.
He picked up an AKM, jacked around into the chamber.
Can't we kill the son of a bitch now?
Anik laughed like a ringing bell.
Your political sophistication never ceases to amaze me, Laffer.
Wolf hiked up the sleeve of his coat and checked his wristwatch. What happens now is that you, Annika, and you, Wilfried, will go and telephone the message we agreed upon to the crisis center the authorities have so conveniently established. We've both proved we can play the waiting game. It's time to make things move a little.
And Comrade Molnia said, No. The fear was gathering. Bit by bit, it coalesced into a cancer, black and amorphous in the center of his brain. With each minute's passage, it seemed Molnia's heart gained a beat. His ribs felt as if they were vibrating from the speed of his pulse. His throat was dry and raw. His cheeks burned as though he stared into the open maw of a crematorium. His mouth tasted like offal. He had to get out. Everything depended on it. Everything.
No!
A part of him cried.
You've got to stay. That was the plan.
Behind his eyes he saw his daughter Ludmilla sitting in the rubbled building with her melted eyes running down blistered bubbled cheeks.
This is at stake, Valentin Mikhailovich. Another, deeper voice replied. If anything goes wrong, do you dare entrust this errand to these adolescents?
No,
he said.
His parched palate would barely produce the word.
I'll go.
Wolf frowned. Then the ends of his wide mouth drew up in a smile. Doubtless it occurred to him that they would leave him in complete control of the situation.
Fine, let him think as he will. I've got to get out of here.
Mikey blocked the door, Mackie Messer with tears thronging the lower lids of his eyes. Molnia felt fear spike within him, almost ripped off a glove to shock the boy from his path. But he knew the young ace would never harm him, and he knew why. He mumbled an apology and shouldered past. He heard a sob as the door shut behind him, and then only his footsteps pursuing him down the darkened hall.
One of my better performances, Puppet Man congratulated himself. Cake.
Mackie beat his open palms on the door. Molnia had abandoned him. He hurt, and he couldn't do anything about the hurt. Not even if he made his hands buzz so they'd cut through steel plate. Wolf was still here. Wolf would protect him. But Wolf hadn't. Not really. Wolf had let the others laugh at him. Him! Mackie the ace. Mackie the knife. It had been Molnia who'd stood up for him the last few weeks. Molnia who had taken care of him. Molnia who was gone. Who wasn't supposed to go. Who was gone. He turned, weeping, and slid slowly down the door to the floor.
Exhilaration swelled Puppet Man. It was all working just as he had planned. His puppets cut the capers he directed and suspected nothing, and here he sat, at a breath's distance, drinking their passions like brandy. Danger was no more than added poignance. He was Puppet Man, and in control. And finally the time had come to make an end of Mackie Messer and get himself out of here. Annika stood over Mackie, taunting.
Cry, baby. And you call yourself a revolutionary?
He pulled himself upright, whimpering like a lost puppy. Puppet Man reached out for a string and pulled. And Comrade Ulrich said,
Why didn't you just go with the rest of the jokers, you ugly little queer?
Kreuzberg, Neumann said. Slumped in his chair, Tachyon could barely muster the energy to lift his head and say, I beg your pardon. 10 o'clock was ancient history now. So, he feared, was Senator Greg Hartman. Neumann grinned. We have them. It took the devil's own time, but we traced the van. They're in Kreuzberg. The Turkish ghetto next to the Wall. Sarah gasped and quickly looked away. An anti-terrorist team from GSG-9 is standing by, Neumann said. Do they know what they're doing? Tack asked, remembering the afternoon's fiasco. They're the best. They're the ones who sprang the Lufthansa 737 the Nur al-Allah people hijacked to Mogadishu in 1977. Hans Joachim Richter himself is in charge. Richter was the head of the 9th Border Guards Group, GSG-9, especially formed to combat terrorism after the Munich Massacre of 72. A popular hero in Germany, he was reputed to be an ace, though nobody knew what his powers might be. Tack stood. Let's go.
Mackie's left hand cut right down Comrade Ulrich's right side, from the base of his neck to the hip. It felt good going through, and the kiss of bone thrilled him like speed. Ulrich's arm fell off. He stared at Mackie. His lips peeled back away from perfect teeth, which clacked open and closed 3 times, like something in the window of a novelty store. He looked down at what had been his perfect animal body and shrieked. Mackie watched in fascination. The scream made his exposed lung work in and out like a vacuum cleaner bag, all grayish purple and moist and veined with blue and red. Then his guts started to spill out the side of him, piling over his fallen rifle, and the blood rushing out of him carried away the strength that kept him standing, and he dropped.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, Wilfried said.
Puke slopped from a corner of his mouth as he backed away from the wreckage of his comrade. Then he looked past Mackie and yelled,
No!
Annika aimed her Kalashnikov at the small of the ace's back. Fear knotted her finger, sphincter tight. Mackie phased out. The burst splashed Wilfried all over the wall.
Molnia stood with hands on knees and his back against the side of a stripped Volvo, pulling in deep breaths of diesel-flavored Berlin night. It wasn't a part of town in which strangers cared to spend much time alone. That didn't concern him. What he feared was fear.
What came over me? I've never felt like that in my life.
He'd fled the apartment in a bright haze of panic. No sooner had he stepped outside than it evaporated like water spilled on sun-heated rock in the Khyber. Now he was trying to collect himself, unsure for the moment whether to carry on with his errand or go back and send a couple of Wolf's vicious cubs.
Papertin was right, he told himself. I've gotten soft.
From above came a familiar heavy stutter. His blood ran like Freon through his veins as he raised his head to see fire flashes dancing on chintz curtains 2 stories up. It was all over.
If I'm not found here, he thought, then maybe, conceivably, the Third World War won't happen tonight. He turned and walked away down the street, very fast.
Hartman lay on his side with the floorboards throbbing against the bruise on his cheekbone. He kicked the chair over as soon as things started happening. What in hell's name went wrong, he wondered desperately. The bastard wasn't supposed to talk. Just shoot! It was 76 all over again. Once again, Puppet Man in his arrogance had overreached himself, and it may just have cost him his ass. His nostrils buzzed with the stink of hot lubricant and blood and fresh moist shit. Hartman could hear the two surviving terrorists stumbling around the room, shouting at each other. Ulrich was dying in wheezes a few feet away. He could feel the energy running from him like an ebb tide.
"Where is he? Where'd the fucker go?" Wolf was saying.
"He went through the wall,"
Annika said. She was hyperventilating, tearing the words out of the air like pieces of cloth.
"Well, watch for him. Oh, holy Jesus."
Their terror was stark as crucifixion as they stood trying to cover all three interior walls with their guns. Hartman shared it. The twisted ace had gone berserk. Someone shrieked and died.
Mackie stood for a moment, with his arm elbow deep in Annika's back. He took the buzz off, leaving his hand jutting from the woman's sternum like a blade. Blood oozed greasily around the leather sleeve on Mackie's arm, where it vanished into her torso. He enjoyed the look of it, and the intimate way what remained of Annika's heart kept hugging his arm. "The fools hadn't even been looking his way when he slipped back through the wall from the bedroom. Not that it would have helped them if they had." Three quick steps, and that was it for red-headed little Comrade Annika. "Fuck you," he said, and giggled. The heart convulsed one last time around Mackie's arm and was still. Putting a slight buzz on, Mackie pulled his arm free. He swung the corpse around as he did so. Wolf was standing there with his cheeks quivering. He brought up his gun as Mackie turned. Mackie pushed the corpse at him. He fired. Mackie laughed and phased out. Wolf emptied the magazine in a shivering ejaculation. Plaster dust filled the room. Annika's corpse collapsed across the senator. Mackie phased back in. Wolf screamed please, in German, in English. Mackie took the Kalashnikov away from him, pinned him against the door, and taking his time about it, sawed his head in two. Right down the middle.
Riding in the armored van with the particolored lights of downtown Berlin washing over her and the faces and weapons of the GSG-9 men who sat facing her, Sarah Morgenstern thought, "What's come over me?" She wasn't sure whether she meant now or before, weeks before, when the affair with Greg began. How strange. How very strange. How could I have ever have thought I loved him? I feel nothing for him now. But that wasn't really true. Where love had left a vacuum, an earlier emotion was seeping in, tainted with a toxic flavor of betrayal. Andrea, Andrea, what have I done? She bit her lip. The GSG-9 commando riding across from her saw and grinned, his teeth startling in his blackened face. She was instantly wary, but there was no sex in that smile, only the self-distracting camaraderie of a man facing battle with both pleasure and fear. She made herself smile back and nestled closer against Tachyon, sitting by her side. He put his arm around her. It wasn't just a brotherly gesture. Even the prospect of danger wasn't enough to drive sex wholly from his mind. Oddly, she found she didn't mind the attention. Perhaps it was her acute awareness of how incongruous they were, a pair of small, gaudy cockatoos riding among panthers. And Greg. Did she really care what happened to him? Or do I hope he never leaves that tenement alive?
The screaming had stopped, and the buzzsaw sounds. Hartman had feared they might go on forever. He gagged on the reek of friction-burned hair and bone. He felt like something from a medieval fable as painted by Bosch, a glutton presented with the fullest of feasts, only to have it turn to ashes in his mouth. Puppet Man had drawn no nourishment from the terrorists dying. He had been nearly as terrified as they. A humming coming closer. Moritat, the ballad of Mackie the Knife. The mad ace was locked in killing frenzy now, stalking toward him with his terrible hand still dripping brains. Hartman writhed in his bonds. The woman Mackie had impaled was a dead weight across his legs. He was going to die now. Unless. Bile surged up his throat at what he was going to do. He choked it back, reached for a string, and pulled hard. The humming stopped. The soft talking of clogs on wood stopped. Hartman looked up. Mackie leaned over him with glowing eyes. He pulled Annika off Hartman's legs. He was strong for his size, or maybe inspired. He pulled Hartman's chair upright. Hartman winced, dreading contact, fearing death, fearing the alternative almost as much. His own breathing nearly deafened him. He could feel the emotion swelling within Mackie. He steeled himself and stroked it, teased it, made it grow. Mackie went to his knees before the chair. He unfastened the fly of Hartman's trousers, slipped fingers inside, tugged the senator's cock out into the humid air, and fastened his lips around the glands. He began to pump his head up and down, slowly at first, then gaining speed. His tongue went caduceus, round and round. Hartman moaned. He couldn't let himself enjoy this. "If you don't, it's never going to end," Puppet Man taunted. "What are you doing to me?" "Saving you, and securing the best puppet of all." "But he's so powerful, so unpredictable." Involuntary pleasure was breaking his thoughts into kaleidoscope fragments. "But I've got him now, because he wants to be my puppet. He loves you, the way that neurasthenic bitch Sarah never could." "God, God, am I still a man?" "You're alive, and you're going to smuggle this creature back to New York, and anyone who stands in our way from now on will die. Now relax and enjoy it." Puppet Man took over. As Mackie sucked his cock, he sucked the boy's emotions with his mind. Hot, wet, and salty, they gushed into him. Hartman's head went back. Involuntarily, he cried out. He came, as he had not come since Succubus died. Senator Greg Hartman pushed through a door from which the glass had long since been broken. He leaned against the cold metal frame and stared into a street that was empty, except for gutted cars and weeds pushing up through cracks in the pavement. White light drilled him from the rooftop opposite, fierce as a laser. He raised his head, blinking. "My God!" a German voice yelled. "It's the senator!" The street filled up with cars and whirling lights and noise. It didn't seem to take any time at all. Hartman saw magenta highlights struck like sparks off Tachyon's hair, and Carnifex in his comic book outfit, and from doorways and behind automotive corpses appeared men totally encased in black, trotting warily forward with stubby machine pistols held ready. Past them all he saw Sarah, dressed in a white coat that was the defiant antithesis of camouflage. "I got away," he said, voice creaking like an unused door. "It's over. They killed each other." Television spotlights spilled over him, hot and white as milk fresh from the breast. His gaze caught Sarah's. He smiled, but her eyes drilled into his like iron rods. Cold and hard. "She slipped away," he thought. With the thought came pain. But Puppet Man wasn't buying pain, not tonight. He drove himself into her through the eyes, and she came running for him, arms spread, her mouth a red hole through which love words poured, and Hartman felt his puppet wrap her arms around his neck and makeup-streaked tears gush onto his collar and he hated that part of him that had saved his life. And down away where light never was, Puppet Man smiled.
Mirrors of the Soul by Melinda M. Snodgrass. Read for you by Raphael Sparge. April in Paris. The chestnut trees resplendent in their pink and white finery, the blossoms drifting like fragrant snow about the feet of the statues in the Tuileries garden, and floating like colorful foam atop the muddy waters of the Seine. April in Paris. The song bubbling incongruously through his head as he stood before a simple gravestone in the Cimetière Montmartre, so hideously inappropriate. He banished it only to have it return with greater intensity. Irritably, Tachyon hunched one shoulder, took a tighter grip on the simple bouquet of violets and lily of the valley. The crisp green florist's paper crackled loudly in the afternoon air. Away to his left, he could hear the urgent bleat of horns as the bumper-to-bumper traffic crawled up the Rue Norvin toward Sacré-Cœur, with its gleaming white walls, cupolas, and dome. The cathedral floated like an Arabian Nights dream over this city of light and dreams. The last time I saw Paris. Earl, his face holding all the expression of an ebony statue, Lena, flushed, impassioned. You must go, looking at Earl for help and comfort. The quiet, it would probably be best, the path of least resistance. So strange. From this, of all men. Tachyon knelt, brushed away the petals that littered the stone slab. Earl Sanderson Jr., Noir Aigle, 1919-1974. You lived too long, my friend. Or so it was said. Those busy, noisy activists could have used you better if you'd had the grace to die in 1950. Even better, while liberating Argentina, or freeing Spain, or saving Gandhi. Laid the bouquet on the grave, a sudden breeze set the delicate white bells of the lilies to trembling, like a young girl's lashes just before she was kissed, or like Bly's lashes just before she wept. The last time I saw Paris. A cold, bleak December, and a park in Neuilly. Blythe Van Rensselaer, a.k.a. Brain Trust, died yesterday. Gracelessly he surged to his feet, dusted the knees of his pants with a handkerchief, gave his nose a quick, emphatic blow. That was the trouble with the past. It never stayed buried. Straddling the slab was a large, elaborate wreath, roses and gladiolas and yards of ribbon. A wreath for a dead hero. A travesty. A small foot came up, sent the wreath tumbling. Contemptuously, Tachyon walked over it, grinding the fragile petals beneath his heel. One cannot propitiate the ancestors, Jack. Their ghosts will follow. His certainly were. On the Rue Etex, he hailed a cab, fished for the note, read off the name of the Left Bank Café in rusty French, settled back to watch the unlit neon signs flash past. XXX, Le Fi, Les Sexy. Strange to think of all this smut at the foot of a hill whose name translated as the Mountain of Martyrs. Saints had died on Montmartre. The Society of Jesus had been founded on the hill in 1534. They proceeded in noisy and profane lurches, bursts of heart-stopping speed followed by neck-wrenching stops, a blare of horns, and an exchange of imaginative insults. They shot through the Place Vendôme, past the Ritz, where the delegation was housed. Tachyon hunkered deeper into his seat, though it was unlikely he would be spotted. He was so sick of them all. Sarah, quiet, sleek, and secretive as a mongoose. She had changed since Syria, but refused to confide. Peregrine, flaunting her pregnancy, refusing to accept that she might not beat the odds. Mistral, young and beautiful. She had been tactful and understanding and kept his shameful secret. Fantasy, sly and amused. She had not. Hot blood washed his face. His humiliating condition was now public, to be sniggered at and discussed in tones ranging from the sympathetic to the amused. His hand closed tightly on the note. There would be at least one woman he could face without embarrassment. One of his ghosts, but more welcome than the living right now. She had chosen a cafe on the Boulevard Saint-Michel, in the heart of the Latin Quarter. The area had always despised the bourgeoisie. Tachyon wondered if Danelle still did, or had the years dampened her revolutionary ardor. One could only hope it had not dampened her other ardors. Then he remembered, and shrunk down once more. Well, if he could no longer taste passion, he could at least remember it. She had been 19 when they'd met in August of 1950, a university student majoring in political philosophy, sex, and revolution. Danelle had been eager to comfort the shattered victim of a capitalist witch hunt, the new darling of the French intellectual left. She took pride in his sufferings, as if the mystique of his martyrdom could rub off with bodily contact. She had used him, but by the ideal he had used her, as a shroud, a buffer against pain and memory, drowned himself in cunt and wine, nursing a bottle in Lena Goldoni's Champs-Élysées penthouse, listening to the impassioned rhetoric of revolution. Caring far less for the rhetoric than the passion. Red-tipped nails meeting a slash of red for a mouth as Danny puffed inexpertly at larynx stripping Galois. Black hair as smooth as an ebony helmet over her small head, lush bosoms straining at a too-tight sweater, and short skirts that occasionally gave him tantalizing glimpses of pale inner thigh. God, how they had screwed. Had there ever been any emotion past mutual using? Yes, perhaps, for she had been one of the last to condemn and reject him. She had even seen him off on that frigid January day. That was when he'd still had luggage and a semblance of dignity. There on the platform of the Montparnasse railway station, she had pressed money and a bottle of cognac onto him. He hadn't refused. The cognac had been too welcome, and the money meant that another bottle would follow. In 1953, he had called Danny when another fruitless visa battle with the German authorities had sent him careening back into France. Called her, hoping for one more bottle of cognac, one more handout, one more round of desperate fornication. But a man had answered, and in the background he had heard a child crying, and when she had finally come to the phone, the message was clear. Get fucked, Tekyan. Tittering. He had suggested that was why he had called, the unpleasant buzz of a disconnected phone. Later, in that cold park in Neuilly, he'd read of Blythe's death, and nothing had seemed to matter anymore. And yet, when the delegation arrived in Paris, Danny had reached out, a note in his box at the Ritz, a meeting on the left bank as the silver-gray Parisian sky was turning to rose, and the Eiffel Tower became a web of diamond light. So maybe she had cared, and maybe to his shame, he hadn't. Dome was a typical working-class Parisian café. Tiny tables squeezed onto the sidewalk, gay blue and white umbrellas, harried, frowning waiters in none-too-clean white smocks, the smell of coffee and grillade. Tack surveyed the handful of patrons. It was early yet for Paris. He hoped she hadn't chosen to sit inside. All that smoke. His glance kept flicking across a thick-set figure in a rusty black coat. There was a watchful intensity about the rattled face and Dear God, could it? No.
Bonsoir, Tachyon.
Danel. He managed faintly and groped for the back of a chair. She smiled an enigmatic smile, sucked down some coffee, ground out a cigarette in the dirty ashtray, lit another, leaned back in a horrible parody of her old sexy manner, and eyed him through the rising smoke. You haven't changed. His mouth worked, and she laughed sadly. The platitude, a little hard to force out. Of course I've changed. It's been 36 years. 36 years. Blythe would be 75. Intellectually, he'd accepted the reality of their pitifully short lifespans, but it had not come home to him before. Blythe had died. Bronn remained unchanged. David was lost, so like Blythe, remained a memory of youth and charm. And of his new friends, Tommy, Angel Face, and Hiram were just entering that uncomfortable stage of middle age. Mark was the merest child. Yet 41 years ago, it had been Mark's father who had impounded Tack's ship. And Mark hadn't even been born yet. Soon, or at least as his people measure time, he would be forced to watch them pass from youth into inevitable decay and thence into death. The chair was a welcome support as his rump hit the cold wrought iron. Danel, he said again.
A kiss, Taki, for old time's sake.
Heavy yellowish pouches hung beneath faded eyes. Gray brittle hair thrust into a careless bun. The deep gouges beside her mouth into which the scarlet lipstick had bled like a wound. She leaned in close, hitting him with a wave of foul breath. Strong tobacco, cheap wine, coffee, and rotting teeth, combining in a stomach-twisting effluvium. He recoiled, and this time, when the laughter came, it seemed forced, as if she hadn't expected this reaction and was covering the hurt. The harsh laugh ended in a long coughing jag that brought him out of his chair and to her side. Irritably, she shrugged off his soothing hand.
Emphysema. And don't you start, le petit docteur. I'm too damn old to give up my cigarettes, and too damn poor to get medical attention when the time comes to die. So I smoke faster, hoping I'll die faster, and then it won't cost so much at the end.
Danel.
Bon Dieu, Tachyon, you're dull. No kiss for old time's sake, and apparently no conversation either. Though, as I recall, you weren't much of a talker all those years ago.
I was finding all the communication I needed in the bottom of a cognac bottle.
It doesn't seem to have inconvenienced you any. Behold, a great man.
She saw the world-renowned figure, a slim figure dressed in brocade and lace, but he, gazing back at the reflections of a thousand memories, saw a cavalcade of lost years, cheap rooms stinking of sweat, vomit, urine, and despair, groaning in an alley in Hamburg, beaten almost to death, accepting a devil's pact with a gently smiling man. And for what? Another bottle. Waking hallucinations in a cell in the tombs. What are you doing, Danel?
I'm amazed at the Hotel Intercontinental.
She seemed to sense his thought.
Yes, and unglamorous end to all that revolutionary fervor. The revolution never came, Taki.
No.
Which doesn't leave you broken-hearted.
No. I never accepted all of your versions of utopia.
But you stayed with us until finally we threw you out.
Yes, I needed you, and I used you.
My God, such a soul-deep confession. At meetings like this, it's supposed to be all bonjour and comment allez-vous, and my, you haven't changed, but we've already done that, haven't we?
The bitter mocking tone added a razor's edge to the words.
What do you want, Danel? Why did you ask to see me? Because I knew it would bother you. The butt of the Galois followed its predecessor into a squashed and ashy death. No, that's not true. I saw your little motorcade pull in, or flags and limousines. It made me think of other years and other banners. I suppose I wanted to remember, and alas, as one grows older, the memories of youth become fainter, less real. I unfortunately do not share that kindly blurring. My kind do not forget. Poor little prince. She coughed again, a wet sound. Tachyon reached into his breast pocket, pulled out his wallet, stripped off bills. What's that for? The money you gave me, and the cognac, and 36 years interest. She flinched away, eyes bright with unshed tears. I didn't call you for charity or pity. No. You called to rip at me. Hurt me. She looked away. No. I called you so I could remember another time. They weren't very good times. For you, maybe. I loved them. I was happy. And don't flatter yourself. You weren't the reason. I know. Revolution was your first and final love. I find it hard to accept that you've given it up. Who says I have? But you said, I thought, even the old can pray for change, perhaps even more fervently than the young. By the way, she drained the last of her coffee with a noisy slurp. Why wouldn't you help us? I couldn't. Ah, of course. The little prince, the dedicated royalist. You never cared about the people. Not as you used that phrase. You reduced them to slogans. I was bred to lead and to protect and to care for them as individuals. Ours is a better way. You're a parasite. And in her face he saw a fleeting shadow of the girl she had been. An almost rueful smile touched his lips. No, an aristocrat, which you would probably argue is synonymous. His long forefinger played among the little pile of francs. Despite what you think, it really wasn't my aristocratic sensibilities that kept me from using my power on your behalf. What you are doing was harmless enough, unlike this new breed who think nothing of killing a man merely for being successful. She hunched her shoulder. Please, get to the point. I'd lost my powers. What? You never told us? I was afraid of losing my mystique if I had. I don't believe you. It's true, because of Jack's cowardice. His face darkened. The Huac returned blithe to the stand. They were demanding the names of all known aces, and because she had my mind, she knew. She was about to betray them, so I used my power to stop her, and in so doing broke her mind, and left the woman I loved a raving maniac. He raised trembling fingertips to his damp forehead. The retelling in this, of all cities, infused it with new power, new pain. It took years for me to overcome my guilt, and it was the turtle who showed me how. I destroyed one woman but saved another. Does that balance the scales? He was speaking more to himself than to her. But she was not interested in his ancient pain. Her own memories were too intense. Lena was so angry, she called you a disgusting user, taking and taking and giving nothing in return. Everyone wanted you out because you had so spoiled our beautiful plan. Yes, and not one person took my side, not even Earl. His expression softened,
as he looked past the ruin of age to the beautiful girl he remembered. No, that's not true. You defended me. Yes, she admitted gruffly. Little good that it did. It took me years to regain the respect of my comrades. She stared blindly down at the tabletop. Tachyon glanced at the watch in his boot heel, rose. Danny, I must go. The delegation is due at Versailles by 8, and I must change. It's been... He tried again. I'm so glad that you contacted me. The word seemed stilted and insincere even to his own ears. Her face crumpled, then stiffened into bitter lines. That's it? 40 minutes and au revoir? You wouldn't even drink with me? I'm sorry, Danny, my schedule. Ah, yes, the great man. The pile of bills still lay between them on the table. Well, I'll take these as an example of your noblesse oblige. She lifted up a shapeless bag and fished out a billfold, scooped up the francs and jammed them into the battered wallet, then paused and stared at one photo. A cruel little smile played about her wrinkled lips. No, better yet. I'll give you value for your money. Gnarled, arthritic fingers pulled free the picture and tossed it onto the table. It was a breathtaking still of a young woman, a river of red hair half masking the narrow, shadowed face, a mischievous, knowing look in the up-tilted eyes, a delicate forefinger pressed against a full lower lip as if shushing the onlooker. Who is she? Dak asked, but with a breath-stopping certainty that he knew the answer. My daughter. Their eyes locked. Danny's smile broadened. And yours. Mine. The word emerged as a wondering, joyful sigh. Suddenly, all the weariness and anguish of the trip sloughed away. He had witnessed horrors, jokers stoned to death in the slums of Rio, genocide in Ethiopia, oppression in South Africa, starvation and disease everywhere. It had left him feeling hopeless and defeated. But if she walked this planet, then it could be born. Even the anguish over his impotence faded. With the loss of his virility, he had lost a major part of himself. Now it had been returned to him. Oh, Danny. Danny. He reached across and gripped her hand. Our daughter. What is her name? Giselle. I must see her. Where is she? Rotting. She's dead. The words seemed to shatter in the air, sending ice fragments deep into his soul. A cry of anguish was torn from him, and he wept, tears dropping through his fingers. Danny walked away. Versailles, the greatest tribute to the divine right of kings ever constructed. Tachyon, heels tapping on the parquet floor, paused and surveyed the scene through the distorting crystal of his champagne glass. For an instant, he might have been home, and the longing that gripped him was almost physical in its intensity. There is indeed no beauty in this world. I wish I could leave it forever. No, not true. He amended as his gaze fell upon the faces of his friends. There is much here still to love. One of Hartman's polished aides was at his shoulder. Was this the one fortunate enough to have survived the kidnapping in Germany, or had he been flown in specially to serve as cannon fodder for this line-withering tour? Well, perhaps the increased security would keep this young man alive until they could reach home. Doctor, Monsieur de Valmy would like to meet you. The young man forced a path for Tachyon while the alien studied France's most popular presidential candidate since de Gaulle. Franchot de Valmy, said by many to be the next president of the Republic, a tall, slim figure moving easily through the crowd, his rich chestnut hair was streaked with a single 2-inch bar of white. Very striking. More striking, though far less evident, was the fact that he was a wild card, an ace, in a country gone mad for aces. Hartmann and de Valmy were shaking hands. It was an outstanding display of political soft soap. Two eager hunters using one another's power and popularity to catapult them into the highest offices in their lands. Sir, Dr. Tachyon. De Valmy turned the full force of his compelling green-eyed gaze onto the Tachyon. Tachyon, raised in a culture that put a high premium on charm and charisma, found that this man possessed both to an almost Tachyon magnitude. He wondered if that was his wild-card gift. Doctor, I am honored. He spoke in English. Tack placed a small hand over his breast and replied in French, the honor is entirely mine. I will be interested to hear your comments on our scientists' work on the wild-card virus. Well, I have only just arrived. He fingered his lapel, raised his eyes, and pinned de Valmy with a sharp glance. And will I be reporting to all the candidates in the race? Will they also wish to hear my comments? Senator Hartmann took a small step forward, but de Valmy was laughing. You are very astute. Yes, I am, how do you Americans say, counting my chickens. With reason, said Hartmann with a smile. You've been groomed by the president as his heir apparent. Certainly an advantage, said Tachyon. But your status as an ace hasn't hurt. No? I would be curious to know your power. De Valmy covered his eyes. Oh, Monsieur Tachyon, I'm embarrassed to speak of it. It's such a contemptible little power, mere parlor tricks. You are very modest, sir. Hartmann's aide glared, and Tack stared blandly back, though he regretted the momentary flash of sarcasm. It was ill-bred of him to take out his weariness and unhappiness on others. I am not above using the advantage granted to me, Doctor, but I hope that it will be my policies and leadership that will give me the presidency. Tachyon gave a small laugh and caught Greg Hartmann's eye. It is ironic, is it not, that in this country, the wild card bestows a cachet to help a man into high office, while in our country, that same information would defeat him. The senator pulled a face. Leo Barnett. I beg your pardon? Asked de Valmy in some confusion. A fundamentalist preacher who's gathering quite a following. He'd restore all the old wild-card laws. Oh, worse than that, Senator. I think he would place them in detention camps and force mass sterilizations. Well, this is an unpleasant subject. But on another unpleasant subject, I'd like a chance to talk to you, Franchot, about your feelings on the phase-out of medium-range missiles in Europe. Not that I have any standing with the current administration, but my colleagues in the Senate. He linked arms with de Valmy, and they drifted away, their various aides trailing several paces behind, like hopeful pilot fish. Tack gulped down champagne. The chandeliers glittered in the long line of mirrors, multiplying them 100-fold, and throwing back bright light like shards of glass into his aching head. He took another swallow of champagne, though he knew the alcohol was partly to blame for his present discomfort. That, and the drilling hum of hundreds of voices, the busy scrape of bows on strings, and outside the watching presence of an adoring public. Sensitive telepath that he was, it beat on him like an urgent, hungry sea. As the motorcade had driven up the long chestnut-lined boulevard, they had passed hundreds of waving people, all eagerly craning for a glimpse of the Les As Fantastiques. It was a welcome relief after such hatred and fear in other countries. Still, he was glad that only one country remained, and then he would be home. Not that anything waited for him there, but more problems. In Manhattan, James Spector was on the streets. Death incarnate, stalking free. Another monster created by my meddling. Once home, I must deal with this. Trace him, find him, stop him. I was so stupid to abandon him in favor of pursuing Roulette. And what of Roulette? Where can she be? Did I do wrong to release her? I am undoubtedly a fool where women are concerned. Tachyon! Peregrine's gay call floated on the strains of Mozart and pulled him from his introspective fog. You've got to see this. He pinned a smile firmly in place and kept his eyes strictly off the mound of her belly thrust aggressively front and center. Mordecai Jones, the Harlem auto repairman, looking uncomfortable in his tuxedo, nervously eyed a tall golden crystal lamp as if expecting it to attack. The long march of mirrors brought back thoughts of the funhouse and Dez, the fingers at the end of his elephant's trunk twitching slightly, heightened the memory. The past. It seemed to be hanging like a dead weight from his shoulders. The knot of friends and fellow travelers parted and a hunched, twisted figure was revealed. The Joker lurched around and smiled up at Tack. The face was a handsome one, noble, a little tired, lines about the eyes and mouth denoting past suffering. A kindly face. His, in fact. There was a shout of laughter from the group as Tack gaped down into his own features. There was a shifting like clay being mashed or a sponge being squeezed, and the Joker faced him with his own features in place. A big square head, humorous brown eyes, a mop of gray hair set atop that tiny, twisted body. Forgive me, the opportunity was too enticing to pass up, chuckled the Joker. And your expression, the best of all, Tacky, put in Chrysalis. You can laugh, you're safe, he can't do you, rumped Dez. Tack, this is Claude Bonnel, Le Miroir. He's got this great act at the Lido. Poking fun at the politicos, rumbled Mordecai. He does this hysterical skit with Ronald and Nancy Reagan, giggled Peregrine. Jack Braun, drawn by the laughing group, hovered at its outskirts. His eyes met Tachyon's, and the alien looked through him. Jack shifted until they were at opposite sides of the circle. Claude's been trying to explain to us this alphabet soup that's French politics, said Digger. All about how Duvalmy has welded an impressive coalition of the RPR, the CDS, the JJSS, the PCF. No, no, Mr. Dance. You must not include my party among the ranks of those who support François Duvalmy. We communists have better tastes and our own candidate. Who won't win? Ejected Braun, frowning down at the tiny Joker. The features blurred, and Earl Sanderson Jr. said softly, there were some who supported the goals of world revolution. Jack, face gone sickly white, staggered back. There was a sharp crack as his glass shattered in his hands and a flare of gold as his biological force field came to life to protect him. There was an uncomfortable silence after the big ace had left. Then Tachyon said coolly, thank you. My pleasure. You are here as a wild card representative. Partly, but I also have an official capacity. I am a member of the Party Congress. You are a big wheel with the commies, whistled Digger, with his usual lack of tact. Yes. How did you pick up Earl? Or have you just made it a point to study those of us on the tour? Asked Chrysalis.
I have a very low-level telepathy, and I can pick up the faces of those who have deeply affected a person. Hartman's aide was once again at his side. Doctor, Dr. Kovasar has arrived and wants to meet you. Takia made a face. Duty calls. So, pleasure must be foregone. Gentlemen, ladies. He bowed and walked away. An hour later, Tak was standing by the small chamber orchestra, allowing the soothing strains of Mendelssohn's Trout Quintet to work its magic. His feet were beginning to hurt, and he realized that 40 years on Earth had robbed him of his ability to stand for hours. Recalling long past deportment lessons, he tucked in his hips, pulled back his shoulders, and lifted his chin. The relief was immediate, but he decided that another glass would also help. Flagging down a waiter, he reached for the champagne, then staggered and fell heavily against the man as a blinding, directionless mind assault struck his shields. Mind control. The source. Outside. Somewhere. The focus. He was dimly aware of crashing glasses as he slumped against his startled support. Forced up lids that seemed infinitely heavy, so distorting was the effect of his own psi search and the screaming power of the mind control that reality took on a strange shifting quality. The reception guests in their bright finery faded to gray. He could see the mind probe like a brilliant line of light, becoming diffuse at its source, impossible to pinpoint, but haloing. A man, uniform, one of the security captains, attaché case, bomb. He reached out with his mind and seized the officer. For a moment, the man writhed and danced like a moth in a flame as his controller and Tak fought for supremacy. The strain was too much for his human mind, and consciousness left him like a candle being snuffed. The major went down, spraddle-legged, on the polished wood floor. Tak found his fingers closing about the edges of the black leather case, though he couldn't remember moving. Controller knows his lost focus. Time detonated or command detonated. No time to ponder on it. The solution, when it came, almost wasn't conscious. He reached out, gripped the mind. Jack Braun stiffened, dropped his drink, and went running for the long windows overlooking the front garden and fountains. People flew like ninepins as the big ace came barreling through them. Tachyon cocked back his arm, prayed to the ancestors for aim and strength, and threw. Jack, like a hero in a 40s football film, leapt, plucked the spinning case from the air, tucked it tight into his chest, and launched himself out the window. Glass haloed his gold glowing body. A second later, and a tremendous explosion blew out the rest of the windows lining the Hall of Mirrors. Women screamed as razor-edged glass shards bit deep into unprotected skin. Glass and gravel from the yard pattered like hysterical raindrops onto the wood floor. People rushed to the window to check on Braun. Tachyon turned his back on the windows and knelt beside the stentoriously breathing major. One should have priorities. Let's go over it again. Tak eased his aching buttocks on the hard plastic chair, shifted until he could take a surreptitious glance at his watch. 12:10 a.m. Police were definitely the same the world over. Instead of being grateful for his having averted a tragedy, they were treating him as if he were the criminal. And Jack Braun had been spared all this because the authorities had insisted on carting him off to the hospital. Of course he wasn't hurt. That was why Tachyon had selected him. No doubt by morning the papers would be filled with praise for the brave American ace, thought Tak sourly, never noticing my contributions. Monsieur? Prodded Jean-Baptiste Rochambeau of the French Sûreté. To what purpose? I've told you, I sensed a powerful, natural mind control at work. Because of the user's lack of training and control, I was unable to pinpoint the source. I could, however, pinpoint its victim. When I fought for control, I read through to the controller's mind, read the presence of the bomb, mind-controlled Braun, tossed him the bomb, he went out the window, the bomb exploded, with him no worse for the wear except perhaps wearing some of the topiary. There is no topiary beyond the windows of the Hall of Mirrors, sniffed Rochambeau's assistant in his nasal, high-pitched voice. Tack swung around in the chair. It was a little joke, he explained gently. Dr. Tachyon, we are not doubting your story. It's just that it's impossible. No such powerful mentat, he looked to Tachyon for confirmation, exists in France. As Dr. Corvisart has explained, we have every carrier, both latent and expressed, on file. Then one has slipped past you. Corvisart, an arrogant gray-haired man with fat cheeks like a chipmunk's and a tiny pursed butt of a mouth, gave a stubborn headshake. Every infant is tested and registered at birth. Every immigrant is tested at the border. Every tourist must have the test before they can receive a visa. The only explanation is the one I have suspected for several years. The virus has mutated. That is patent and utter nonsense. With all due respect, Doctor, I am the foremost authority on the wildcard virus, on this or any other world. Perhaps something of an exaggeration, that, but surely it could be forgiven. He had been enduring fools with such patience for so many hours. Corvisart was quivering with outrage. Our research has been acknowledged as the best in the world. Ah, but I don't publish. Tachyon was on his feet. I don't have to. A single step advance. I have a certain advantage. Another. I helped develop the withering thing. He bellowed down into the Frenchman's face. Corvisart held stubbornly firm. You are wrong. The mentat exists. He is not on file, ergo the virus has mutated. I want to see your notes. Duplicate the research. Look over these vaunted files. This he addressed to Rochambeau. He might have the soul of a policeman, but at least he wasn't an idiot. The Surite officer cocked an eyebrow. Do you have any objections, Dr. Corvisart? I suppose not. You want to start now? Why not? The night's ruined anyway. They set him up in Corvisart's office with an impressive computer at his disposal, bulging hard copy files of research, a foot-high stack of disks, and a cup of strong coffee that Tack liberally laced with brandy from his hip flask. The research was good, but it was geared toward proving Corvisart's pet premise, the hope of fame in the form of a mutated form. Wild Cardus Corvisartus was subtly coloring the Frenchman's interpretations of the data he was collecting. The virus was not mutating. Thank the gods and ancestors, Tack sent up as a heartfelt prayer. He was scrolling idly through the wild card registry when an anomaly, something not quite right, caught his attention. It was 5 in the morning, hardly the time to scroll back several years to check if he'd seen what he thought he'd seen. But upbringing and his own curious nature could not be denied. After several minutes of fervid key tapping, he had the screen divided and both documents called up side by side. He fell back in the chair, rumpling his already tumbled curls with nervous fingers. Well, I'll be damned, he said aloud to the silent room. The door opened and the adenoidal sergeant thrust in his head. Monsieur, you require something? No. Nothing. His hand shot out, and he erased the damning documents. What he discovered was for him alone, for it was political dynamite. It would create havoc with an election, cost a man the presidency, and shake the foundations of trust of the electorate, should it get out. Tack pressed his hands into the small of his back, stretched until vertebrae popped, and shook his head like a weary pony. Sergeant, I am very much afraid that I have found nothing that is of any help, and I am too tired to go on. May I please be returned to the hotel? But his bed at the Ritz had held no comfort or rest, so here he was leaning over the bridge railing on the Pont de la Concorde, watching coal barges slip by, and snuffling eagerly at the smell of baking bread which seemed to have permeated the city. Every part of his small body seemed to be suffering from some discomfort. His eyes felt like two burned holes in a blanket. His back still ached from that impossible chair, and his stomach was demanding to be fed. But worst of all was what he had dubbed his mental indigestion. He had seen or heard something of significance, and until he hit upon it, his brain was going to continue to seethe like jelly boiling on a stove. Sometimes, he told his mind severely, I feel as if you have a mind of your own. He began walking through the Place de la Concorde, where Marie Antoinette had lost her head, the spot now marked by a venerable Egyptian obelisk. There were plenty of restaurants to choose from, the Hotel de Crillon, the Hotel Intercontinental, just two blocks from the square, where Danny was, no doubt, hard at work, and beyond at the Ritz. He hadn't seen any of his companions since the dramatic events of the previous night. His entrance would be met with exclamations, congratulations. He decided to miss the whole mess. He was still wearing his reception finery, pale lavender and rose and a foam of lace. He frowned when a taxi driver gaped and drove over a curb and almost into one of the central fountains. Embarrassed, Tachyon darted through the richly decorated iron railing and into the Tuileries Gardens. On either side loomed the Jeu de Pomme and the Orangerie. Ahead, the neat rows of chestnut trees, fountains, and a riot of statues. Tack dropped wearily onto the edge of a basin. The fountain squirted into life and sent a fine spray of mist across his face. For a moment he sat with eyes closed, savoring the cool touch of the water. Retreating to a nearby bench, he pulled out the picture of Giselle and again studied those delicate features. Why was it that whenever he came to Paris, he found only death? And suddenly, the piece fell into place. The puzzle lay complete before him. With a cry of joy, he leapt to his feet and broke into a frantic run. The high heels of his formal pumps slipped on the gravel path. Cursing, he hopped along, pulling them off. Then, with a shoe in each hand, he flew up the stairs and onto the Rue de Rivoli. Horns blared, tires squealed, drivers shrieked. He ran on heedless of it all. Pulled up, gasping, before the glass and marble entrance to the Hotel Intercontinental, met the bemused eyes of the doorman, slipped his feet into his shoes, straightened his coat, patted at his tumbled hair, trod casually into the quiet lobby. Bonjour. The desk clerk's eyes widened in dawning wonder as he recognized the extravagant figure before him. He was a handsome man in his mid-30s, with sleek, seal-brown hair and deep blue eyes. You have a woman working here, Danielle Moncey. It is vital that I speak with her. Moncey? No, Monsieur Tachyon, there is no one by... Damn, she married. I forgot that. She's a maid, mid-50s, black eyes, gray hair. His heart was thundering, setting up an answering pounding in his temples. The young man looked
nervously down at Tachyon's hands, which had closed urgently about his lapels, pulling him half over the counter. Releasing the clerk, Tachyon rubbed his fingertips. "Forgive me. As you can see, this is very important. Very important to me. I'm sorry, but there is no Danelle working here." "She's a communist," Tack added in desperation. The man shook his head, but the pert blonde behind the exchange counter suddenly said, "Ah, no, Francois, you know, Danelle." "Then she is here?" "Oh, mais oui, she's on the third floor. Will you get her for me?" Tachyon gave the girl his best come-hither smile. "Monsieur, she is working," protested the desk clerk. "I only require a moment of her time." "Monsieur, I cannot have a cleaning woman in the lobby of the Intercontinental." It was almost a wail. "Blood's end. Then I'll go to her." Danelle was bundling sheets into a hamper, gasped when she saw him, tried to bull past him using her cleaning card as a battering ram. He danced aside and caught her by the wrist. "We must talk." He was grinning like a fool. "I'm working. Take the day off. I'll lose my job." "You are not going to need this job any longer." "Oh? Why not?" A man and his wife stepped out of their room and stared curiously at the couple. "This won't do." She eyed him, checked her cheap wristwatch. "It's almost my break. I'll meet you at a Café Moron just down from the hotel on the Rue de Juliet. Buy me some cigarettes and my usual." "Which is?" "They'll know. I always take my breaks there." He took her face between his hands and kissed her, smiled at her confused expression. "What has happened with you?" "I'll tell you at the café." As he hurried back through the lobby, he saw the desk clerk just hanging up the phone in one of the public booths. The young blonde woman waved and called. "Did you find her?" "Oh, yes. Thank you very much." Tachyon fidgeted at one of the tiny tables that had been squeezed out front of the café. The street was so narrow that the parked cars had two wheels cocked up on the sidewalks. Danny arrived and lit a Gauloise. "So what is this all about?" "You lied to me." He shook a finger coyly under her nose. "Our daughter is not dead. At Versailles, that was not a wild card. It was my blood kin. I don't blame you for wanting to hurt me, but let me make it up to you. I'll get you both back to America." A small car was gunning down the street. As it swept past, the chatter of automatic weapon fire echoed off the gray stone buildings. Danelle jerked in the chair. Tachyon caught her, flung them both down behind one of the parked cars. A white-hot poker burned through his thigh, and his elbow hit the sidewalk with a jarring crack. He lay frozen, cheek pressed to the pavement, something warm running over his hand. His leg had gone numb. Danelle's breath was rattling in her throat. Tachyon took her mind. Giselle appeared, reflected a million times over in a million different memories. Giselle. A brilliant firefly presence. Desperately, he reached after her, but she was receding, a lost and elusive magic among the darkening pathways of her dying mother's mind. Danelle died. Giselle died. But had left a part of herself. A son. Tack clung to her, violating every rule of advanced mentatics by holding to a dying mind. Panic seized him, and he fled back from that terrifying boundary. In the physical world, the air was filled with the undulating wail of sirens. Oh, ancestors, what to do? Be found here with a murdered hotel maid? Ludicrous. There would be questions to be answered. They would learn of his grandchild, and if wild cards were a national treasure, how much more a treasure was a part-blood Takesian. The pain was beginning. Tachyon experimentally moved the leg and found that the bullet had missed the bone. The effort had popped sweat and filled the back of his throat with bile. How could he possibly reach the Ritz? He tightened his jaw, because he was a prince of the House Ilkazam. It's only two blocks, he thought encouragingly. He laid Danelle gently aside, folded her hands on her bosom, kissed her forehead. Mother of my child. Later he would mourn her properly, but first came vengeance. The bullet had passed cleanly through the fleshy part of his thigh. There wasn't much blood yet. As he walked, he began to pump. Camouflage, something to hide the wound, just long enough to get past the desk and up to his room. He checked in parked cars, a folded newspaper, and the window was open. Not perfect, but good enough. Now he just had to find enough control not to limp those few steps from the front door to the elevator. Piece of cake, as Mark would say. Training was everything, and blood would always tell.